Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After 9/11, the gloves came off, as they say, in the world of American intelligence and security. So did budget restraints, accountability, oversight. 2 years ago, Washington Post reporters Dana Priest and William Arkin began probing the scale and reach of this exploding, top-secret America. Dana Priest joins us today. So does Glenn Greenwald of Salon.com. This hour on Point, we're looking at the sobering, worrying reality of the scale of top-secret America. You can join the conversation. Do you sleep better or worse at night with this vast undercover intelligence world humming around you? Is this really what we need? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear a very personal civil liberties story from folk singer Vance Gilbert, who was recently pulled off a plane for reading the wrong book and, maybe, the color of his skin. But joining me first today from Washington is two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The Washington Post, Dana Priest. Her new book with William Arkin is Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. Dana Priest, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you with us.
Glad to be here, Tom.
We talked when your series came out in The Washington Post in, what was it, 2010. You've pushed it forward, put it all in a book now. You've also worked with Frontline and PBS to put out a big documentary that airing this week in the U.S. I wonder if we could listen for just a little to a couple of clips from that, Dana, if you'd be kind enough to bear with us here. Just to get a sense of how this got going, here's from the Frontline documentary. Here's Cofer Black. He was director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center on September 11th. Just days after the attack, he presented the White House with a blueprint for a covert war in Afghanistan. He spoke to Congress on September 26th, 2002.
This is a very highly classified area. All you need to know is that there was a before 9/11 and there was an after 9/11. After 9/11, the gloves come off.
In the Bush-Cheney era, did it stop with Obama? Well, no. John Rizzo has been called the most influential lawyer in CIA history. Veteran lawyer approved many of their most controversial methods after 9/11. In 2009, he briefed the incoming Obama administration. In an interview with Frontline, he says the Obama administration intended from the beginning to keep CIA's covert operations intact.
His people were signaling to us, I think partly to try to assure us that they weren't going to come in and dismantle the place, that they were going to be just as tough, if not tougher, than the Bush people.
And why? Here's Richard Clark, terrorism advisor to the White House and the Bush administration, telling PBS's Frontline that no president wants to cut the intelligence budget for fear of being blamed for a future attack.
There's going to be a terrorist strike someday. And when there is, if you've reduced the terrorism budget, the other party, whoever the other party is at the time, is going to say that you were responsible for the terrorist strike because you cut back the budget. And so it's a very, very risky thing to do.
The work of Washington Post reporter Dana Priest and William Arkin, very deeply embedded in that Frontline documentary. Dana Priest is with us right now from Washington, D.C. Dana, just run us back through the scale issue. We'll talk about reach and oversight or the lack thereof, but just how much this world has grown.
Well, we took 3 years to investigate that, and what we found is that the budget for counterterrorism and intelligence, which is what we looked at, is about 250% larger than it was on the day of the attacks. And that is because Congress wrote a blank check over and over again and would fund almost anything that the Defense Department and intelligence agencies could come up with, and then the Department of Homeland Security as well, which was created later. We worked at the top secret level, meaning that we found companies and organizations of the federal government working at the top secret level because secret was, there were just too many things to look at. We probably couldn't have documented them all in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the top secret level, we found about 2,000 corporations working for the federal government on programs that are classified at top secret, and another about 1,200 federal organizations that work at the top secret level. About 860,000 people have top secret clearances. That's about the size of Washington, D.C. itself.
850,000. Top secret, not just secret.
Right. Secret, there are millions. Top secret is much more difficult to get. And of those, about a quarter of a million, 250,000, are contractors, private contractors working for the government. As you probably know, right after 9/11, the Congress and the president didn't want it to appear as if government was growing, so they spent all this money mainly to hire contractors rather than to grow the federal workforce at all.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought originally, or the idea originally was that it would actually save money, but it's not turned out to do that at all. In fact, contract employees make 2 to 3 times as much money as their federal employee counterparts. What's more, contractors are supposed to supplement the core workers that are government employees, but that's not happened either. Contractors now do virtually everything that federal employees do, including covert action. At the CIA, there's that famous white marble wall of stars representing people who have died in the line of duty. And of the 22 stars there of people who died in the line of duty after 9/11, 8 of the 22 are actually contractors. So they are ingrained in what is going on in this giant world that is spread across the country. What we did is we mapped it, and we came up with what we call an alternative geography of the United States. It's another way to look at it is sort of the genome project for the secret world that grew up and was scattered around the United States, but clustered mainly in Washington, D.C., and up into the Baltimore area, where hundreds and hundreds of these companies and agencies are located.
And to give people just a sense of the scale, I mean, up 250% since 9/11, that's from a very large base. Construction and offices, I think you said 3 times the size of the Pentagon, as vast as the Pentagon is holding these?
If they had put it all together in one spot, which would be hard to find that land, but people would have noticed. But if they spread it out like they did, then you don't notice. It's hiding in plain sight in places that look like office buildings and are scattered amid office buildings. We counted just the biggest buildings that we knew about, and we counted 33 of them, and yes, that's about 3 times the size of the Pentagon, if not more. Even the newest agency to be created after 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security, that's under construction now, and when in Washington, in a corner of Washington that not many people visit anyway, but when it's done, it will be as big, if not slightly bigger, than the Pentagon. And that's for an agency with 88,000 employees whose role, in many people's opinion, is still a questionable one. What does DHS really contribute to our safety?
And that's just a piece. That's just a piece of this top secret world, as you say, public, private contractors, thousands of them. You quote one from the public side, we're the dark matter in this top secret world. It says, we're the dark matter, we're the force that orders the universe but can't be seen. You say that this world is become so enormous, so unwieldy, and so secretive that no one knows how much money it costs, how many people it employs, how many agencies duplicate work being done elsewhere. There seem to be two big angles here, Dano, and one is accountability for what's being done, and the other is what does it mean when a country, even the size of our democracy, gets a top-secret world of intelligence security so large and so invested in its own ongoing existence that it's kind of out of control of the very democracy it's supposed to be serving.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that is what it's supposed to do, serve all of us. And I do think it's out of control, not in the sense that it's doing things that somebody isn't authorizing it to do, but its growth and the programs that it undertakes are not as, we put in place the Director of National Intelligence in 2004. Congress decided and the president wanted this to happen because they knew this had been growing and they knew that they needed to get their arms around it. So they created this office and put somebody in charge of it an intelligence czar, if you will. Mm-hmm. But that person has not been able to do that. The laws were weak, and the political will to do that was just not there. And so they recognized that this was going to grow out of, it was going to become too unwieldy, and they did something about it, but it didn't work. However, that office also grew enormously. It's a secret office where you're not supposed to know where it is. It's an undisclosed location, but it's in the middle of a very pricey neighborhood in Fairfax County, and you can see it from the road during the winter if you're in a certain spot like we did. It's the size of five Walmarts stacked on top of one another. It's 500,000 square feet of office space with people doing who knows what and contributing, again, who knows what. Of course, we're safer than we have been since 9/11 because there are organizations that are very precise, very focused, very using very experienced people to do what it's taken to make the country safer than it was. But it's not this huge thing that has also grown up and become its own sort of branch of government.
Dana Priest and William Arkin write, 10 years after the attacks of 9/11, more secret projects, more secret organizations, more secret authorities, more secret decision-making, more watch lists, and more databases are not the answer to every problem. In fact, more has become too much. Their big new book is Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the rise of America's huge undercover intelligence and security world post 9/11 and what it means. Dana Priest is with us. She and William Arkin, both of the Washington Post, she, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, are out with their new book, Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State, frontline documentary this week based on their investigation. We've all been hearing a lot about it. So has our friend Glenn Greenwald with Salon.com, former constitutional lawyer. He joins us today from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Glenn, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
You're on with Dana. You've been reading her work on this for a long time, I'm sure. What about, I mean, there's the whole intelligence side. Are we safe or are we not when it's so big and so gangly? But what about the dangers potentially even to ourselves, the surveillance of ourselves? We've got people online here writing, you know, one wonders what the founding fathers would have thought about what we've become. I think they would have been devastated, says James Turner. What do you think, Glenn?
Well, it's interesting. I think the work that Dana has been doing, you know, for the last several years and now with Bill Arkin is among the most important journalism taking place in the country. And it's interesting that, you know, 5 decades ago, Dwight Eisenhower, in his farewell address to the nation, warned of what he called this military-industrial complex that would be so secretive and so powerful that it would form its own unaccountable branch of government and threaten to subvert democracy. And that's really what we're talking about. And I think that the two biggest implications of this top secret America that this new book describes is that, first of all, we know that when this kind of power is exercised in the dark without accountability, that it is inevitably abused. I mean, we know that theoretically to be true, just basic political science, that the corrupting nature of power. But we also know specifically that in the wake, for example, of the Church Committee's investigation in the mid-1970s, what they found was that when this kind of intelligence community was allowed to operate in the dark, that there were huge systematic abuses, and the only solution was a system of regimented oversight and transparency. And that's exactly what we've dispensed with in the wake of 9/11. The other aspect of it is that when you make the surveillance state so vast that it just collects more and more information, ironically, what it does is it actually begins to undermine security because there's too much information to be able to detect what's important. And if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, for example, what they found was that it wasn't that the government didn't collect the information that was necessary to detect the plot, but it just had too much of it, and it wasn't able to process it. And the vast amount of surveillance that our government engages in against us, the citizenry, which it was never supposed to do, is so extreme that it's hard to see how, even if you believe that's not dangerous, it could be possibly constructive, just given the quantity of it.
Dana Priest, let's just stick with that for a moment, because we're remembering 9/11 this week. That was a terrible attack. Thousands of Americans died. No one wants it to happen again. Just in terms of efficacy and good, well-functioning
security in this country. Is your conclusion that this scale of top secret America has made us safer or not, better off in terms of, you know, the functioning of our security apparatus or not?
Well, I agree with Glenn. The scale is what undermines it all. Because if you look at what, where, how terrorists are found, it's from small organizations, relatively small organizations, who have very skilled and experienced staff. It's not from hundreds of analysts looking at the same information or, you know, an Army intelligence officer who did landmines and IEDs one day and is moved over to do counterintelligence the next day and has no background in it. And they recreate the wheel. And they don't add anything to the intelligence. They don't add anything, really, to the goal of finding and defeating al-Qaeda and their affiliates. And so, yes, I mean, and officials within the system, some of them on the record mentioned this as well, that you know, they don't know how many special access programs there even are, and that's the programs that are even more highly classified than top secret. And this can, in, secrecy undermines democracy, but it also undermines the working of government itself, because people within it, even people who are quote-unquote sharing information, you can hide information, even with good motives. You can obscure and put obstacles in the way of sharing through high classification of certain programs, and that has gone on as well.
Dana Priest,
so even within government, they don't know, you know, what is going on.
You and William Arkenwright, it is time to close the decade-long chapter of fear, to confront the colossal sum of money that could have been saved or better spent to remember what we're truly defending, and in doing so, to begin a new era of openness and better security against our enemies. Our listeners are crowding in here. Nashville, Tennessee, Will. Thanks for calling. Will, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Actually, that last comment about where money could have been spent is one of the major points I want to make. You know, we have this nation that, you know, this secret, you know, existence that is going about doing global negative, you know, going about trying to get rid of terrorism, when it feels like this money could have been spent, all these billions and billions of dollars could have been spent on global positives. I mean, imagine a place where people would not want to come terrorize because we do so much global positive. That would be a wonderful thing. And I'm a teacher, and so I feel like I'm in the intelligence business sometimes.
As in building intelligence, honing intelligence, I hope.
Right, exactly. And how you hone intelligence is it seems different than what is going on. If you see kids playing with a toy and they look at you with that look, you know they're not using it appropriately. You take it away and you teach them how to use it appropriately. And it seems like this secretive community is just that infantile, that fear of, oh goodness, if we get caught, we'll have to explain what we've been doing.
Yeah, let me take that to Dana, if I may, Will. But first, one more from Pittsburgh. Mike, you're on the air. Thank you, Will. Mike, you're on.
Thanks a lot. Excellent show as always. Listen, I got a couple of quick comments, kind of a question. I'm calling it the classified card, cloaking and classification. I would like to know really quick, first question, who makes the call? Back to me, let's go right to the source. Who is the one at the gates with the thumbs up, thumbs down, saying, well, this is classified, this isn't?
Yep.
And great point when you talk about all the money and all the people and all the manpower involved. When you're talking about, let's say, computer hacking and people attacking an infrastructure via computer, the more people and more hands are involved, the more vulnerable you are to a computer attack. I'm going to get off the phone and listen to you guys. Great.
Michael, I'll pick that up as well. Who makes the call on what's top secret? And one more before we do. Rick in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Rick, you're on with Dana Priest and Glenn Greenwald.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have the question, if there's any responsibility on the on the authors of the books and the articles that were like the ones published in the Washington Post,
yep,
on Sunday, about the actual procedures and the naming of names that we're using to take in America's bad guys, that's kind of not really helping and hindering and putting the soldiers and sailors and Marines that are going downrange in harm's way. When they start talking about us doing, you know, certain things that they mentioned in the Sunday article that I don't want to repeat over the phone right now or on the radio. They're giving information to our bad guys. It's called counter-intel, and they're putting it in an open-source information. And I wonder if they could actually, you know, look my children in the face and realize and understand that they're putting me at danger when Daddy goes away.
Rick, I appreciate your call. Dana, let's pick that one up first. We won't lose yours, Mike, but Dana, what about it?
Sure. No, I mean, we take all of that very seriously, and every story I write that has either classified information in it or sensitive information, I'm always running it by people who are inside, either the public affairs people who take it elsewhere or the people who know the business the best. And this is something that happens with national security reporters in Washington. And there are things that are not in the book. There are many things that are not in the book that were not in that article that you're referring to for that reason. It's a delicate balance. And in our country, the press does have the deciding vote, so to speak, on what goes in a newspaper because we don't have prior censorship. And we take our national security responsibilities in that regard very, very seriously, and usually have a lot of discussion about what should and should not go into an article.
But you've written very deeply about the JSOC and the Navy SEALs and all the rest, the operations going on, Stanley McChrystal, the general in charge of that. I mean, is there a point at which it's too much, or are you making the call that Americans need to know because it's their government?
Well, first, it's not me. It's the publisher of the paper and, in general, the editors who discuss it all with me.
But we hope it's you in the end because you know this realm the best. I mean, what do they know about what's really critical and what's not?
You know, they're questioning me. I'm talking to them. And then we have outside counselors, if you will, people who are in the community, people who used to be in the community who help us think through these issues as well. Again, in that JSOC story, there were a lot of details, but a lot of things were left out. And the things that are in, we don't believe, you know, risk lives, certainly, but also risk procedures or practices.
Glenn, I want to get to you, but what about Mike in Pittsburgh and his question? Who makes the call, Dana, about what's
these
top secret?
Question. So who makes the call on classified information is the agency that's doing the classifying, the agency that's doing the actual activity, which one could say is sort of the chicken guarding the hen house. And what every commission that looks at overclassification has found is that people err on the side of classifying more rather than less, mainly because they don't want to make a mistake, but also because they're sometimes ill-informed about what exactly might cause, for instance, grave damage to the national security, which is the definition of top secret. And finally, I want to get to the very first question on the positives versus the negatives.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons that so much money is spent on what he called the negatives, what I would call the military intelligence wing rather than the non-military sort of State Department diplomacy development.
The terrorism industrial complex.
Mm-hmm. So much of it is spent in that regard because those agencies are much stronger. They're viewed as much more effective than our non-military agencies of government. And as one of my favorite generals said, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you get these agencies that are good at what they're doing, more money goes to them. And then they get better and bigger at what they do, which happens to be, not development, not diplomacy, not social fabric building. It's defense and offensive military action.
Until they become so big, as you describe it, that they're too big and that efficacy may go away. Not to mention, there's a lot of retired generals out there on that gravy train. Glenn Greenwald, you're listening to all this. And just the first point of top secret, and what is top secret, how it gets that way. I mean, Dana describes it, but anybody can imagine the temptation to make things top secret because then you're less accountable. There's a little bit of CYA kind of cover your hinder here, in addition to no doubt some element of it that's very important for our honest national security.
Well, we know that that's happened throughout history. There are many examples where things have been marked classified, secret, top secret, that didn't pose any real danger at all, but were designed to cover up serious wrongdoing at the highest levels of government, the Pentagon Papers being one of the best examples and most well-known. And it really goes to the caller's last point. I mean, of course, any time that people in power want to keep things in secret and somebody, a journalist or a whistleblower, exposes it, they're going to accuse that person of having endangered national security. That's just the instinctive defense to that act. And I think what needs to be realized is that there's huge dangers as well, not from excessive leaking, but from excessive secrecy. To allow governments to operate in the dark not only breeds huge amounts of inefficiency, but very corrupt and threatening behavior. And I would say that if you look at modern history, what you would see is that far more people have had their rights abridged or their lives ended by their own governments acting without accountability than they have by, say, foreign terrorists attacking them on their soil. And we tend to spend a lot of time thinking about the latter danger of foreign threats and the like, and very little danger that comes from our own government acting with too much secrecy, even though we have so many examples of how damaging that can actually be.
Let me take Fred in Salem, Massachusetts on here. Hi, Fred, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Tom, thank you. Let's see, I'm in the maritime industry, and we have to use my license, I've had to get what they call a TWIC. TWIC, Transport Workers Identification Credential.
Okay.
And this is administered by, you know, part of that industrial security complex, Lockheed Martin. I actually have to pay it. I think the last time it was $160 to me. And for me to operate a boat and use my license, I can't operate without it. And I think the trucking industry has to do the same. And I think the airline pilots are the same, but I'm just...
A lot of people have licenses. What's the big deal about this one, Fred?
Well, I've already had to get my license, I've already had an FBI background check. Now, they got a private contractor administering this. It was supposed to be all done by the Coast Guard, but now...
Yeah. You got a smart chip? You have a smart chip in that license?
Absolutely. And the irony is that I can't use that when I go through security at the airport.
So what's your concern? That's amazing. What's your concern here, Fred, as a citizen?
Well, they've just created another security industry, you know, with this, and it's costing me money, and I'm sure they're getting money from the government. And my other concern is that just talking about this, you could be considered an adversary of the state.
Which gets into freedom of speech and all the rest. Glenn, we've only got you for a couple more minutes. Think with us about civil liberties here for a minute. The whole idea is to protect this country and the freedom, the democracy, the liberties that we cherish here. We're spending billions, as Dana and Bill Arkin point out. But is there a point at which it begins to erode? I mean, we've got Saeed writing online. This reminds me of the secret police surveillance team's concept adopted by many of the Middle East dictators.
Well, and I think that's, you know, a good point. There was a controversy last year that the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia began banning BlackBerries because they were incapable technologically of invading them and intercepting the communications on them. And there was lots of outrage in the West and in the United States over this kind of failure to appreciate freedom. And yet the United States government and other Western governments are insisting upon very similar powers, the ability to demand that all technologies be constructed so that they can access with a backdoor those communications as well. And what the surveillance state has really done, of course, it's justified in the name of terrorism, but it's swept into it millions and millions and millions of conversations of completely innocent Americans on U.S. soil. Huge databases of private and public entities keeping track of what people do. There's lots of instances where things like the Patriot Act and other investigative authorities have been abused to monitor and even infiltrate peaceful groups engaged in legitimate dissent. And so there has been this slow but steady erosion of what we've always considered to be basic rights in the United States, to say nothing of more extreme cases like detaining American citizens on U.S. soil without due process, as was done in the name of 9/11, that has really changed the kind of country we are and the relationship that we, the citizens, have to our government. And we've allowed that to happen, and that's the reason why it continues.
There's an important thought as we approach this 10th anniversary of 9/11. Glenn Greenwald with Salon.com, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the rise of America's huge undercover intelligence and security world post 9/11 and what it means. Honored to have with us today two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The Washington Post, Dana Priest. She and William Arkin are out with the new book, Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State, the culmination of a couple of 3 years of investigation into the enormous world of top-secret operations, public and very, very widely private, that now in many, many arenas around this country, maybe in your backyard without you even knowing it, are very much at work. There are real security challenges. There are real questions about the scale of what has grown here. Dana Priest joins us from Washington, and let's go straight to Kate in Boston, who's calling. Kate, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to sort of reemphasize something that Dana and Glenn said about how more data doesn't mean more security. In some cases, it actually means less. So there's the needle in the haystack metaphor. Think about the East German Stasi, right? They gathered personally identifiable information about 4 million East Germans, a quarter of the population, but they didn't foresee the movement to overthrow communism there because instead of focusing on actual threats, they were just vacuuming up troves of personal information. So that's one thing. And the second point that I want to make is actually about the fact that privacy and freedom from government interference in our private lives, those are values that are incredibly important, and they're fundamental to our democracy. And I think there's a lot, you know, that idea is getting lost in these conversations. So we're focusing on the efficacy and the amount of money that's spent on these technologies and these data mining programs, but we're forgetting that we're losing something that is fundamentally valuable to our democracy. And my question to Dana is, mm-hmm. you know, what are we protecting, basically? You know, if we're spending all this money to surveil ordinary Americans and we're losing, you know, the Bill of Rights, basically, to things like the Patriot Act, what is it actually that we're protecting? What is it that we're sending our Marines overseas to protect?
Kid, I appreciate your call. Dana, are you ready to put it in stark of terms?
You know, I frankly don't think that we're at that point that you described. I think that that is you know, could be in the future, but I don't think we're there yet. What I do see is a creeping sort of incremental surveillance of broad swath of the population. I call it a dragnet approach to trying to find terrorists and their supporters in the United States. The best example of it is the Department of Homeland Security's See Something, Say Something campaign, or its suspicious activity reporting, which is the same thing, which has encouraged citizens and local police and sheriffs, encouraged with a media campaign, but law enforcement is being encouraged with money that has funded their efforts to do this, as well as intelligence fusion centers in the states where this information is supposed to be collected and analyzed. But it is a broad approach. Someone who looks suspicious because they are Middle Eastern looking and they're taking a picture of a federal building or a bridge, someone who you know, may wear a headscarf, who's taking a picture of a as I write in the book, I have an example, a real example of a family, a Middle Eastern family, who are taking picture of the fire boat in a harbor, and now the man is in the database, is in the FBI's Guardian database.
Yep.
And even though he didn't do anything wrong then, he's going to remain there until, if he is ever seen, if his car is ever spotted in another place where somebody else is suspicious, you know, they can enter it again. By that time, they can collect a lot of information on him. The technology, and one of the reasons that I talk about technology is that the technology revolution has made the collection of information so much easier. The law enforcement can now buy a lot of personal information about you from commercial companies that sell it to, say, the Washington Post when we do our research. They don't need to have the sort of warrants and authorities that they did before. They can just buy it commercially. And so there is just much more information in these databases. We've had many reports, and they're in the book too, of times when the local sheriffs and local police who are not well trained in what is terrorism, what isn't terrorism, put in their databases anti-war protesters, Tea Party activists who've come out to demonstrate, environmentalists, and they then distribute these alerts under the head, under a headline on the documents that say terrorism alert.
So what do we do, Dana? We've only got you for another couple of minutes. What do we do? What's your conclusion as a democracy that wants to be secure but wants to be a democracy, wants to have freedom?
Well, I think we have to start by having an honest discussion about terrorism with our leaders. I mean, that is the root of it, is that people can say we're at great risk and we don't know whether we are or not. And I know many people inside this world who say, you know, we have just about defeated Al-Qaeda. Yes, there are other terrorist groups that have sprung up that are not quite as capable yet, and they're after them as well. And yes, there are lone wolf, crazy individuals in this country who will always do bad things. And those people should be dealt with. But we need people to be honest with us about what the level of threat is and not so general as they have been before.
But don't they have a financial interest, many of these, in not going for that honesty?
Well, members of Congress as well, you know, have not, I think, been doing their job on this. They are too afraid to, you know, make a mistake, be called soft on terrorism. And the cost of that, lack of courage is enormous. The amount of money that is being spent in a time of economic downturn is really gigantic.
Dana Priest, we're so grateful to you for all of your work, for being with us today. Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us, Dana.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Dana Priest, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and William Arkin, co-authors of the new book, Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, we'll hear a personal story about a plane flight and civil liberties from folk singer Vance Gilbert. This is On Point. Vance Gilbert is a singer and songwriter known on the folk circuit for his acoustic tunes.
I've got a plane, don't plan to land it. Don't get me wrong, it's not what you're thinking. There's 110 people aboard, we all agree. We ain't coming down until there is peace.
Coming down for peace, his 2005 song, I've Got a Plane, showcases his good man attitude. He's been a guest on this show now and then since the earliest months after 9/11. Last month, Vance Gilbert, folk singer, was pulled off a plane and questioned as a potential security threat. He says it's partly because he was, or maybe because he was racially profiled, because he was, quote, flying while black. He's with me now in the studio. Vance Gilbert, welcome back to the show. It is very good to see you.
Thanks for having me back, Tom. I wish it was under more strictly musical circumstances, but here I am.
Well, we've known you for a long time. We've enjoyed your music and your attitude and your bonhomie, and now you're a menace to society. What happened? This was last month here in Boston. You're in the plane. It's on the tarmac, and?
We were about to take off, and they turned the plane around and brought it back to the gate. And the captain announced that there would be something was happening and they would be taking off in moments once the issue was resolved.
What was the something? What was the issue?
The issue was, to cut right to it, the state police and the bursar and TSA came and took me off the plane because I was reading a book that had pictures of aircraft in it.
But these are not exactly 747s. This was a book about sort of vintage, almost antique aircraft from the 1920s and 30s. Looking at it right now. It's old sketches.
And it's in Polish.
It's a book
of Polish aircraft. Look, for fun, for giggles, I'm an amateur aviation historian.
Yeah.
And my era is those airplanes that flew before 1950.
Okay, I'm looking here at an Italian, not even biplane, but triplane. This looks like a kind of a Snoopy and the Red Baron. I think that's it. What a policeman even said once they took you out.
Well, once they pulled me off the plane, they handed me over to the state police, which I'm guessing makes the assessment as to whether I'm a threat or not.
Okay.
And that was his reply. He says, why, this is Snoopy and Red Baron stuff. Of course, I corrected him because I'm an aviation historian. But, for all intent and purposes, they put me back on the plane. Twice, actually. I had to go back on and get the book itself, which was kind of strange when you think about it.
If you were the one.
Exactly.
Danger.
Exactly. So you had plenty of time to do whatever I was going to do, like my underwear or my shoe or whatever was supposed to happen. And finally, I got to take the flight. But, you know, for that next hour and a half, people have asked me, And this is a salient point I wanted to get to today. People have asked me,
and
why
here you were
you
on that plane. You're in
plane.
Shorts, baseball hat, T-shirt, hiking boots, Jimmy Buffett Hawaiian shirt.
I'm dressed exactly now as I was then, so you could see just what
a black guy. A bearded guy, a scary guy.
A light-skinned black guy, looking possibly
bespectacled, 50-something. A lot of salt in that beard.
But you don't have to rub it in, Tom. I mean, we're both aging over here now. Come on, seriously.
Okay. I'm sorry.
But no, but exactly. But reminiscent, light-skinned enough that I believe somebody jerked a knee and thought they. You know, somewhere between Osama bin Laden and Mohammed Atta is my skin coloring and look. And I don't think if it had been you, Tom, reading this aviation book on the aircraft, that you would have been pulled off.
Yeah.
And for that hour and a half flight, the people have asked me on all the radio shows and such, why were you sad? Why were you upset?
Because you've written that you silently wept all the way to war. I mean, the whole plane was held up. You write about nobody wanted to meet your eye after they took you off.
Absolutely.
Everybody, you missed flights. A lot of other people may have missed flights as well. You felt racially profiled.
And humiliated. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that had dawned on me the other night was that for an hour and a half, I was the guy that people could suspect to potentially kill 3,000 people. Mm. And what a sensibility that is to think that it's a fleeting burden and it's ridiculous in its own way. But there it was. All eyes on this Embraer 170, whatever the aircraft was, 80 people, a full flight. For a moment, they looked at me as the guy. And that's enough to take your knees out from under you. And that's exactly what it did to me.
Silently weeping to Washington. I mean, you are not that guy.
Well,
you are famously in your music and not that guy, right? I mean, but you're the guy, you're about peace. You go across racial lines, but there are a lot of people out there who are ready to look at it a different way. The Boston Globe, big newspaper, important paper, came in on its editorial pages, and here's a couple of lines from what they wrote. Gilbert, that's you, is African-American but can pass for Middle Eastern. And then they wrote, absent any further evidence to the contrary, the state police, TSA, and the United Airlines acted reasonably.
Well, how racist that is in its own way to say somebody can pass as something else is that kind of terminology that just shows that whoever was writing that day pardon my expression, were dragging their knuckles for sure.
It's 10 years since 9/11. Is it time to get over this? How have you processed what happened?
Oh,
here?
No, it's not time to get over anything.
I mean, not you. I mean, the country, are we racially profiling and dragging people off planes for the wrong reasons?
Oh, well, for sure. For sure. I mean, I guess 100 anecdotes makes a trend, but I've got so many people that claim to be of color that wrote me that said, yeah, sure, it's happened. They've seen it happen. It's happened to them. And a lot of people don't understand, but I would beg people to try to understand. And if not, take your opinions away from my reality.
Have they come back? Anybody and apologize? Said, sorry, Vance?
United officially has to me, and there are some, you know, tiny reparations. I didn't – look, Tom, I'm not about money.
No, I know that.
You know,
you're a folk singer, right?
I'm a folk singer. if I was going to choose something, I'd be something rich like a radio host. But
not a public radio host.
But, you know, it was about just letting people know. I mailed to my aviation list. I mailed to my music list what happened. I wanted to let people know that we're not done. We're simply not done today. And I know that may be hard to hear. The first thing that people want to do is derail the conversation and say, the first they want to go, could it have possibly been anything else other than race? Everything else they were willing to let go except the race part. And in a matter of speaking, that's as racist as anything else, particularly by people of not color to always derail the conversation and tell me what I don't know when I do know it. And that is the most infuriating thing to people of color, to hear what people of non-color think.
Well,
in that instance,
let's listen to each other for just a little bit here. But it's a good, small story with big implications to think about on this 10th anniversary of 9/11. We want to get the balance right in this country. We want to get freedom right in this country. We don't want to be judging for all the wrong reasons in this country. Vance Gilbert's out with a new CD. It is terrific, called Old White Men. We're going to play part of the title track here, which is going to clue you into this man and just how far from that man he is. Vance Gilbert, I'm very grateful to you for coming in today. It's great to see you.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
Vance Gilbert's new CD is Old White Men. We'll go out on the title track, an ode to the men, white men, in his neighborhood who mentored him in his youth. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I was such a strange boy, 40 years or so back then, fat with big, thick old glasses, and trouble making friends. Cruising through my neighborhood could easily have come to no good end, till I stumbled into the workshops of old white men. Call your mother, you can stay. That's about all they'd ever say. Then you take the lid off of some old wooden box, and inside would lay a gem, made of string and spring and wooden glue. Right then and there, I'm sure I knew firsthand the raw ingredients of old white men. Old white men, your teary eyed December 7th. Old white men, salute every flag they see. Old white men, didn't care how cool I couldn't be. A drop of glue will do to help it mend. Put the cap on when you're through, said old white man. It was all ball peen hammers and calipers, dovetail joints and acetone, tubes and printed circuits, screws and spokes and wheels. The difference between truth and opinion, when you're old enough, be sure you vote. And never trust a woman wearing more than 3 heels. Oh, white man, living cross-cut chainsaw lives. Oh, white man, they don't talk back to their wives. Oh, white man, thanks to them, I can sharpen your kitchen knives with the stone. Sometimes when I'm alone, I wonder what became of old white men. Do they synchronize their watches as on and on time marches? Do their belts need extra notches as their waistlines grow big and round? I call their wives a boffin, and I carry their husband's coffin. As these gray hairs of my own chase me down.